This is an interview with James Bregagliano for the SEC Historical Society's virtual museum and archive of the history of financial regulation. I'm Kenneth Durr. Today is July 15th, 2014, and we are at Sidley Austin in Washington, D.C. Mr. Bregagliano, thank you very much for taking some time to talk today. I want to start with the beginning, go back and touch on your education a bit. You went to Amherst, I guess. Are you a New England native, or did you just happen to get up there?
No, I grew up in Long Island, Valley Stream, specifically, in New York State. I went to college at Amherst and graduated in May 1979 with a BA in American Studies.
Did you know that you wanted to go into law with that?
I had some interest in law from my youth. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I expected to go into law.
Okay. And you came to Washington, D.C.?
Yes. Well, I went to law school at Georgetown. Right. So, that brought me to Washington.
Did you develop an interest in securities at that point?
Law? Not specifically. I was more interested in I would say, litigation of some sort. But I then took a job in New York at a small corporate firm called Burke & Burke, where I did a range of corporate and securities transactional matters, and I became somewhat interested in securities regulation at that time.
Mm-hmm. And how did you get an opportunity to come to the SEC?
Well, after a couple years at the firm, like many young associates, I was looking for a government experience, whether at the at a U.S. attorney's office or the SEC, and I had a friend from law school who was working at the SEC, Tom McGonigal, and he spoke highly of his SEC experience, so I sent a resume and came down and interviewed with a couple of divisions, and both the Division of Enforcement and the Office of General Counsel. Had offers from both and joined the General Counsel's office in 1986.
Why'd you choose the General Counsel's office?
Because at that time my interest was more in litigation and writing briefs and doing arguments than it was in investigating securities law violations, which I thought would be much more document intensive versus legal research and writing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And it sounds like you got to do some of the courtroom work, some of the litigation work.
Yeah, I did. There was quite a bit of discovery. We in that office, we were kind of operating like a U.S. attorney's office for the civil division. I was an assistant U.S. attorney with my client, one client being the SEC. But instead of prosecuting, we were doing defensive work, some at the district court level and some at the appellate level, where the SEC or its staff would be challenged in particular activities. For example, if someone took the position that their rights were being violated somehow in an investigation, or an investigation ruined their business, or they didn't want to produce records that the commission wanted, or they wanted records from the commission. They wanted information that the commission viewed as privileged. We would represent the commission. At times, the investigative staff was sought to be deposed. So in a sense, the defense played offense, and they tried to get discovery from the SEC. And so in that case, the enforcement division would represent the commission in the underlying action, and we would represent the staff and the commission in defending whatever the subject of the investigation throughout the commission. It was kind of, okay. We were sort of the guard dog for the program divisions. And sometimes other divisions, witnesses were sought in, for example, major civil trials relating to securities matters. you know, some of those matters might have been before the commission in one way or another, and so the litigants might want information or testimony from staff in the Division of Corporation Finance who may have reviewed a registration statement or may have views about how the regulations work. Sometimes parties in private litigation wanted to take discovery on that material, and we would be that person's lawyer.
Now, this is the mid to late 1980s.
Correct.
What kinds of issues are hot at this point? Was there mergers and
there was some of the insider trading cases. I think Boesky, then the Milken cases. What was called sort of microcap fraud. Mm-hmm. First Jersey was a prominent firm that was selling securities in lots of startup companies, heavily advertising. People had this, they did an ad with Robert Brennan, the president, in a helicopter, and got a lot of press. That activity might be similar to what you would have seen in The Wolf of Wall Street. Mm-hmm. In these boiler room shops, selling dreams.
Was that what Blinder Robinson was?
Blinder Robinson was another firm. Yeah. Stratton Oakmont, was also, I guess, the Jordan Belfort's firm, and Bob Brennan, First Jersey Securities. And so the commission was conducting investigations into those firms, and so those firms were fighting back in a variety of ways. There was lots of discovery. So I got involved in some of those cases. Really, if you think of it as protecting the commission's flank, mm-hmm. while it brought an action, while it surged forward.
So you're just kind of defending the fact that the SEC's ability to do these things is written into the securities law.
That's right. And the idea is that the program divisions would move forward as we defended them, from we were escort fighters for the bombers.
You sort of get them in the trenches. And then
we were police escorts or whatever,
Interesting.
I also did some appellate work just from various cases where, for whatever, we had an appellate section, but they didn't take all the appeals, and we may have been involved early on. So I got to argue in at least a half a dozen courts of appeals, and that was a lot of fun.
These are district courts?
Those are court federal appeals. Federal courts of appeal. One level below the Supreme Court.
Okay.
So those were good cases because you'd write a brief and then have an oral argument before three judges, typically. And it was a very scholarly exercise. Obviously, there'd be someone on the other side, and you'd make your argument and answer questions from the judges. And
any of those stand out in particular?
Yeah, there was a wiretap statute case which went in bank, which means it was not only heard by an appellate panel but by the full Court of Appeals, which was 12 or 13 judges. And that was a case where the commission was pursuing an insider trading investigation that started from a voicemail that was obtained privately by company employees. These employees suspected an affair between an executive and another employee, and so they intercepted phone calls, in a sense, and made tapes. And when one of those tapes involved the executive saying, when we release the numbers next week, the stock's really going to go down. I've shorted it. You should too. That was a sort of a classic insider trading fact pattern. Mm-hmm. So one of the employees took it to the FBI. The FBI gave the tape to the SEC, and the SEC commenced an investigation. The SEC took the executive's testimony and played the tape, at which point the executive lawyer stopped proceedings and went and got an injunction to prevent the SEC from using the tape, then got another injunction to stop the commission's investigation. That was in the district court in Tennessee. So we appealed those and up to the Sixth Circuit in Cincinnati and ultimately prevailed. But during all that litigation, the federal prosecutor in Los Angeles, who had jurisdiction prosecuted criminally the executive and obtained a conviction without the tape. And actually, that was an example of had the defendant just settled, probably would not have been prosecuted.
Yeah.
But that's the most sort of excitement and I would call, say, fun that I've ever had and gotten paid for.
What was the name of that case?
SEC v. Smith.
Okay.
That it was under seal for a while, but then it was unsealed.
Yeah, that would be why it didn't show up when I was doing my research.
So that was a good case because, again, arguing before 12 judges is about as much sort of it's a very stimulating exercise. They're all very well prepared. They have great law clerks. They're scholars, and they ask, you know, the hard questions.
Mm.
And so answering those is fun. It's exciting.
Much more difficult than a single judge, though.
Yeah, maybe. It depends on where the judge is coming from. But the district court actually can be, a district court argument can be more difficult because it's less cabined. It's less the, you know, an appellate argument. In an appellate argument, the issues are more more set out in the briefs. And you're less likely to be surprised, or you should be less likely to be surprised. In a district court, the judge can ask about all sorts of facts that you may not, or other cases, or other business of the commission you may not even know, think is at issue.
Mm-hmm.
And it may not be at issue, but the judge might be interested.
Things can come out of nowhere.
Yeah, I was once in an argument, a tougher moment, where the judge was asking about another case the SEC was handling before him, and he didn't like the way it was handling it, but of course I was not involved in that case at all, yet he thought I should know it chapter and verse. So, you know, it's not always easy.
So what do? You say, I have no idea you're talking to the wrong guy here?
I mean, you can offer to get facts and look into questions that the judge has and then try to steer the judge back to the case at hand, which is what I did.
Okay.
But it's not a comfortable moment. But
yeah.
So in a sense, the district court is much more of a more uncertain environment than the Court of Appeals.
Interesting. You talked about the idea of the shock troops and sort of helping the SEC move the front forward a little bit. And I saw that cases like First Jersey and the Blinder Robinson, they went on for years, I think, or at least almost a year or more. Is that an example of this kind of thing? Are you?
Yes, I mean those cases, particularly First Jersey, went on, and then we would be involved, sporadically, really, where the investigation would go on, and there would be events. Defendants would file a lawsuit, or there'd be a motion, or you'd get a subpoena, and we'd handle it.
So the investigation would stop, you'd deal with it.
It would go on, and that was the point. And the enforcement would keep doing what it's doing, and then we would handle whatever came in.
Okay.
So we were tag teaming.
I want to back up a little bit and talk about the people you trained with when you came in. Was Dan Gelser,
the general counsel at the time. Linda Feinberg was the associate general counsel. They're both extremely qualified people and very talented. I worked with Dan a little bit, but at that time he was, obviously running the whole office.
Right.
And I worked with Linda a little more, but she moved into another area. She moved into policy and off to be counsel for Richard Breeden to do other things. So I didn't have a lot of time with Linda. She's very smart, one of the brightest people I've ever worked with. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to take the job, because frankly, I sort of want to work for people like that.
Yeah.
And then Richard Humes, with whom I worked most of the time, more than anyone there. And Richard was really taught me how to write a brief, and he was a good strategist. He's a terrific lawyer.
Okay.
And also a nice person to work for. But, there are a lot of people. It was you worked with other people in the office. Paul Gonson was a solicitor, and he's, one of the great appellate litigators, I think, in our time, and someone of consummate grace and professionalism, and very, very ethical, insisted that the SEC lawyer was always practice to the highest standards, nothing nothing was said in a brief that it wasn't accurate or well supported. Paul set that standard. Jake Stillman, who's still there, who's brilliant, and he's the appellate, you know, leader extraordinaire. I didn't work with Jake a lot, but you know, he was an icon, still is.
So your title, at least at the beginning, was Special Trial Counsel. Right?
Well, it probably was just staff attorney, mm-hmm. and then Special Trial Counsel, and then Assistant General Counsel. Staff attorney from 86 to 88, Special Trial Counsel from 88 to 91, Assistant General Counsel from 91 to 98.
And how did your job change as you moved up?
Managing instead of writing the first draft of a brief, started supervising others and editing and having staff attorneys under me.
How did the cases that you were dealing with change as you moved through the 1980s?
I think it was the same kind of thing. There was the occasional interesting wiretap case, but a lot of what was called RFPA, right to Financial Privacy Act cases, where when the SEC subpoenaed someone's bank records, they would have a right to challenge the bank or, you know, that subpoena, and the SEC had to demonstrate why it had a right to the records, why they were relevant, and we would write those briefs. Again, lots of discovery against the commission, constitutional actions saying we were violating someone's rights. That smattering always existed. I'm not sure they changed as fundamentally as a group. I just think it was, occasionally there'd be an interesting issue or a more challenging case. Some of the senior commission people were in other divisions, were witnesses for prosecutors in cases that the commission had referred to federal prosecutors. You know, so if the commission did an investigation and it showed conduct that was viewed as criminal, more than just a civil violation, more serious, it might refer the matter to a U.S. attorney's office. They would initiate a prosecution, and then sometimes the prosecutor sought a commission staffer as a witness to basically talk about the securities laws, and I would represent them. And I represented some senior people in corporation finance and trading in markets and that kind of thing. There was then Market Reg.
Right.
Mickey Beach, Bill Morley, both senior people in Corp Fin. And in civil cases, sometimes former employees' testimony were sought, and we would represent them. I represented Chairman Breeden in a deposition when he had left. He had gone to Coopers and Lybrand, I believe. So we went up to New York, and you know, we couldn't stop his deposition, but I was there to assert privileges and work with him because the testimony related to his work. Actually, it was in the Solomon Brothers Treasury bid rigging scandal. It had to do with some conversations he had had with the head of, with John Goodfriend of Solomon Brothers, which was kind of a big deal.
Yeah.
But we couldn't stop that because it wasn't privileged. What a commissioned person says to a civilian, you know, an outsider, it is not governmentally privileged, certainly not once the investigation's over. So plaintiffs in a class action against Solomon Brothers sought Breeden's testimony. They wanted to hear about the phone call. They wanted to establish that basically he had told Goodfriend that, you know, he had a problem, because that would be helpful to their case. So I would I'd go up and represent him in depositions, which I did.
Okay.
So those were interesting.
O'Hagan went through when you were in the general counsel's office.
It did. I know that case. I didn't work on it then. Yeah. That was done by the appellate section.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and Bellsburg was another big case. There were a number of them.
Any others that we should talk about?
Well, there was a Shearson case where the commission took an amicus supporting the securities industry in enforcing arbitration clauses in account agreements. That was very significant. and a case which some of the staff disagreed with, because it basically took the position that if a securities firm required a customer to agree to arbitrate and not go to court for any disputes, that was enforceable. And that was somewhat controversial in the office, but the commission took that position.
But those are that's just sort of staff opinions, I guess? Or
those were just staff. Some staff disagreed with that.
Were these necessarily legal arguments, or just they felt...
More of a policy argument. Yeah. It's not that because it was, whether that should be enforceable, because you could say the customers really don't have any bargaining power, so it's an adhesion contract, and the SEC should not be sanctioning forced arbitration. This, of course, as a policy matter, you can argue the other side, that arbitration is actually a better forum for consumers, because it's litigation in courts is too expensive for most of their cases. So, in a sense, it's not clear. There are arguments on both sides, but it was controversial.
It's interesting, this process you're talking about, sort of talking out the legal implications and arguments on both sides. Was this part of your job as you started to supervise people?
Yeah, well, in our case, you had to consider, the program ramifications of what, you know, what the litigation might bring. We had a case where a judge required a production of an action memorandum, which is the most sensitive commission document, an action memorandum recommending an enforcement action. The judge had a very narrow view of the attorney-client privilege, and so we debated whether to appeal that. And ultimately, we didn't appeal. The way the litigation evolved, it worked out okay. But the choice there would have been sort of, if we lost on appeal, you could have had a more difficult... So the commission often had to decide, if it had a bad district court decision, that might be a bad decision, but it only had a limited impact because it was only governed in that small district.
Yeah.
But, of course, if you appeal, well, you might reverse that. But if you lose, now you've lost in a circuit. If you lose in a circuit, that's much more powerful and a concern for your program. So when you litigate, you always have to think about not just the strength of your – not that your own view of the strength of your arguments of the law, but what are the ramifications of winning or losing, and what your client needs and what the program requires.
So the action memorandum in that case came out, but you managed not to set precedent.
That's
on
right. That's right. Yeah. So, litigation, again, is a result-oriented process where you're trying to put your client in the best position. It's not really about just an argument over who's right.
Right. Any other highlights from the general counsel days?
No, that's about it.
Well, you talked about, you know, this results-oriented process, and I guess it must have been kind of different going into a market rig in some respects. How did you make the transition from the sort of being the lawyer for the SEC to stepping into one of the divisions?
Well, there were a couple assessments that were made. One, I started as I was representing witnesses from the program divisions like corporation finance and market regulation. I became more interested in the underlying securities industry and the regulatory issues. So I started to just be more interested in working, you know, working more directly with that rather than focusing on the litigation. I represented some really interesting experts, and that made me want to, you know, think about working for a program division.
Like who?
Bill Morley and Mickey Beach and Corp Finn and the late Jonathan Kelman in market regulation, Joe Fury in market regulation, of course Chairman Breeden. We represented Rich Lindsay, but not in testimony, just in advising in a case. And then there were people in the Division of Enforcement, of course. That was a bit different. And it also seemed like the focus of the SEC was on policy and regulatory policy, and not so much the general counsel's job, particularly in our area, was not. It was very important, but you weren't in the front lines of recognition. Richard Humes used to say, the only way a commissioner will know your name is if you make a mistake. So you're not. So the beef at the SEC and the star power was not, you know, in that office.
Yeah.
You were support. You were the lineman, not the quarterback.
Right.
So anyway, at the time, as we evolved to the late 90s, it was a dot-com bubble. Markets were booming, and law firms were hiring, and so they were hiring lots of people away from the program divisions, okay. And that created some openings. So I applied for a couple, and I think that it was also very hard to move into a management position from another division, because you were getting a job over staff that already
right.
worked there. It's a difficult move to make. But the turnover was enough, so I think they were willing to take someone with management experience who might stay for a while.
Okay. So you went into the Office of Trading Practices.
Right, to work for Larry Bergman, who was the associate director. Larry had a reputation as being very smart, very scholarly, and very nice, and he's all of those things. He was one of the hardest working people at the commission, and the most thoughtful, and really was a great teacher.
What was the agenda? What was happening in
well, the agenda rank? Early on was started looking, the dot-com bubble burst, and so there was concern about abuses in initial public offerings and whether underwriters, in a sense, created extra froth in the market. These stocks, these companies that never made any money were offering their stock at about $20, and demand was such that it would rise into the hundreds on the first day, which was an absurd valuation. And not all of that was because of bad behavior, but there were concerns that some firms were stimulating the market through their underwriting practices, and so I started to work on those issues. Simultaneously with that, part of that dot-com bubble featured research analysts who became stars on CNBC, and they were talking about the next, Microsoft and which .com was going to go through the roof, and they became media stars as they would have price targets for these new companies that were stratospheric, and they became the stars of the investment banks. The investment banks would compete for business by telling whatever .com that they would take their stock higher, that they would write a more glowing report. Well, that kind of behavior led to some reports that were too glowing. And what concerned us was that there were conflicts of interest that were not disclosed, and a lot of the people who were watching CNBC didn't know that the dot-com company was an important investment banking client of the securities firm, that the analysts might have stock in the company that they were recommending, and so if the stock went up, the person writing the research report stood to make a lot of money when they sold their stock, and we thought disclosure of those conflicts was very important.
Is this in the late 90s? Or
this
we
is
still
in the late 90s, early 90s, early 2000s.
Okay, so this is before this really rose
it
to...
It culminated in what was called the global settlement, frankly, the sort of a research scandal. But we were trying, with difficulty, we were trying to get people interested in having better disclosure for investors so that they would know the conflicts and then they could choose to invest or not. And we were met with resistance. people, the industry didn't want to do it. Some regulators didn't want to you know, discourage the party. No one wanted to turn the music down. And before it crashed.
You could. There was nobody who would logically have listened.
Well, I think they should have listened, but, you know, I mean, they were, again, people don't want to burst the bubble.
Yeah.
Times were good.
How did you go about doing this? Did you just, like, put out releases or
Well,
talk
we didn't
to
get,
people?
We were trying to get releases out. I mean, we were working to, we talked to industry, we talked to the SROs, the New York Stock Exchange, and the NASD to try to get them to enforce their rules,
mm-hmm.
Worked with them and ultimately developed a good working relationship. But it took a while. And frankly, it took certain emails that were found by New York Attorney General Elliot Spitzer, which basically an analyst was viewed to have issued a very favorable report on a .com, meanwhile telling his clients that it really wasn't very good. And so that's not good behavior when, you know, the public is told buy this stock and the key clients are told it's a dog.
Yeah.
And that really culminated. That was a high-profile scandal. And Elliot Spitzer became, you know, an overnight star in some quarters.
What did that mean for the SEC?
Well, it meant for the SEC that they're in a position where it was their turf, and here was a state officer who seemed to be in the lead in ferreting out this scandal. So the SEC ramped up an investigation of all the securities firms, and, you know, more evidence was found that there should be concerns. Again, not everything was wrong, but there were concerns. Anyway, it led to what was called the global settlement,
right,
where all the firms agreed to revise their procedures, and there were extensive rules imposed through that enforcement case. And the market regulation was involved in working with enforcement and OC in you know, helping create, you know, those rules. And at the same time, Congress passed Sarbanes-Oxley, which directed the commission and the SROs to develop additional rules to address analyst conflicts of interest.
I noticed in some cases that there's an issue where Elliot Spitzer and his global settlement, some of the people involved are, you know, they're seeing a mismatch between the terms of the settlement and the SEC rules, and so there's this attempt to catch up in some respects.
Yeah, I mean, there are some differences. The settlement was governed firms that were found to have committed violations. So they had one set of rules, and the SROs, with our assistance, developed rules for the entire industry. And, you know, the view was there might well be different rules because, you know, certain firms that were found to have violated the law and agreed to a settlement, and other firms hadn't, you know, done that. So their rules didn't need to be so strict necessarily.
Now, was this something that enforcement was involved
very,
in?
Very, absolutely. The SEC brought a case against all these firms. That's the global settlement.
Yeah.
So, no, the SEC did a tremendous amount of work in the area, but it was really the catalyst to ratchet it up were those emails that Spitzer found.
Well, how about your group in Market Reg, since you were involved in
this?
Well,
we were working somewhat with, you know, we were working with both the Division of Enforcement and also the SROs to craft rules. So it was a busy time. It was a very big project on a couple of fronts, and ultimately, I think, extensive rules were imposed, but I actually think it's an example to some extent. Had people accepted a more modest regulation earlier, they might not have gotten more extreme regulation later, which to me is a cautionary tale.
Right. Yeah, it's similar to the one you told earlier about the defendant in that case. Crafting rules is something you wouldn't have done in the general counsel's office. process. Is that correct? So tell me a little bit about how you learned to do that and how that process works.
Well, first you need to consider whether you have a regulatory concern, whether there is conduct that you think violates principles of the Exchange Act, because the SEC is governed by the law, and the Exchange Act directs the SEC to address certain areas, to have a national market system, to have markets that are free of manipulation, that firms should have certain levels of capital. There are all sorts of principles that the some fairly specific and some more general, to have information barriers so you don't have misuse of non-public information. And the law is broad, and Congress gives the SEC authority to make more specific rules. So if you see conduct or that is a concern, it may not be illegal, but it may be a concern, then you try to do some fact-finding and consider whether there is a, and sometimes it's a modification of an existing rule, not a whole new rule, whether a rule that governs the activity, let's say short selling, a certain trading activity, is there a way that might be changed? And if you think there is, and it's, you think it's a workable solution, you come up with rule text and proposed and draft a release, and then put it out for comment. And so you get comment from the public, which includes the industry, and often that comment, it really helps the process because there's information that the regulators don't have. And so you have credible comment, often from industry. Not all of it, I think, is very credible, but certainly some is. And you follow up comment letters with meetings and try to see if after reading all the comments you still think there should be a rule and whether it should be modified pursuant to the comments. And that's often the case. And then you recommend that the commission adopt the rule. It's a very long process. It's cumbersome. It can take years. But that's how rulemaking is done.
Is there a tendency to be conservative, just figure out the minimum that you need to do in order not to push things?
Well, I think at the proposing stage, there's a tendency to be a little less conservative, and there should be, because the axiom is you can always cut back, but you can't add at the adoption stage. You can pare back what you've proposed, but you can't adopt something new because people haven't had a chance to comment on it. That's an APA principle, Administrative Procedure Act principle.
Okay.
Right. So that's. And there are lots of people involved in the rulemaking, so you have a staff people that work on it, and rule text is discussed, and there's lots of input. It's a complete team effort, and there's lots of review by the division and then by the commissioners and their councils, and the general counsel's office. So there's other divisions who are interested. So, there's some. Part of the reason it takes long is a good reason. I mean, I think there's, in some cases, it takes longer than it has to.
Right.
But there is extensive input from many, many people. It's never a solo effort to make a rule.
You started the discussion of what was happening in market reg early in your time and sort of leading us up to the global settlement. I would think that, the electronic exchanges... the real big changes that were happening in the markets themselves would have been a big issue at that point.
Well, there are lots of issues. Yeah, I mean, there's the conversion to decimal trading was a significant issue, going from fractions to decimals. We worked on rules in that regard. We worked on a sub-penny rule to prevent trading in sub-pennies.
Was Market 2000 before your time?
No, that was shortly after I arrived.
Okay.
I did not work on that specifically. The division had different units that worked on different things. So
okay.
That was Market Supervision, Howard Kramer, another
But my sense was that was some kind of blueprint, sort of, this is where we think we'd like to go.
Yeah, it was a staff report, which kind of analyzed the status of the markets. And there were order handling rules passed near that time, in response to, another scandal about interpositioning of orders and how certain market makers may be taking advantage of their situation to intermediate in a way that was not good for investors and cost them a lot of money. So there was extensive rulemaking, and that led into then regulation NMS, which is a big deal. Again, that was by the Office of Market Supervision.
Okay.
I'm not going to talk a lot about that.
Were in trading practices.
Yeah, I was in trading practices.
Outline for me what your purview is then.
Well, I mean, again, IPOs and research were a big deal then. We also worked on anti-manipulation rules in connection with tender offers, Rule 14E5, and we worked with the Office of Mergers and Acquisitions. We did a lot of no-action letters in connection with mostly cross-border tender offers. Another big facet was short selling. When the markets went down, particularly, then there became more of a focus on short selling, which some people view as a way that some people can drive a price of a security down. But there were a couple of big issues going on in short selling, and one was whether to have a price test. And historically, you couldn't short below the last trade or the last sale price.
Because the tick test?
Yes, the tick test. The idea was that short sellers should not lead the market down. If the price of a stock was going to fall, it should be owners of the stock that led that, not speculators. That was from the 30s. There came to be a view that the tick test was no longer necessary. There was good surveillance for manipulation, and it interfered with the smooth provision of liquidity. The commission ultimately did a pilot program to test the tick test and ultimately discarded it. These were long rulemakings, and that's a lot of. And then it brought back a circuit breaker after sometime around the meltdown, when markets plunged again, and the circuit breaker imposed another price test. Instead of being based on the last sale, it was based on the bid, and so you couldn't be below the best bid and lead the market down that way. Same idea, but only if a stock had declined by 10%. So it's a test that's not in effect most of the time. But when Chairman Shapiro came in, a lot of Congress apparently asked her to look at bringing back a short sale price test, because during the meltdown, when stocks went from 14,000 to 7,000, there was concern about short sellers.
Yeah, are you talking about talking about the flash crash?
I'm talking about the meltdown in 07 and 08 that came in, and when stocks went down generally. No, this is over a couple of years.
Right.
And so a price test was brought back. The other thing that happened was that, actually even before that, the focus of short selling switched from the price test to preventing naked short selling and people shorting without borrowing stock. And failing on their trades because they would short stock and not deliver. So we passed rules to address that. We rewrote the short selling regime.
Right.
And then that was a big deal.
That's Reg Show.
That's Reg Show.
Okay. So. Tell me when short selling becomes a problem and why. When did you first start noticing this?
Well, short selling, can be a problem if a stock is viewed as weak, and short sellers can kind of pile on and exacerbate a decline in a way that the maybe in excess of what you know what a sort of a non-manipulated market would entail.
Right.
There's a great deal of debate as to whether that happens. I mean, and I don't think it's been proven that that exists. It certainly can exist, but I don't know that's very extensive. But there is a strong political view that's somewhat skeptical of short sellers, because after all, they're selling something they don't own.
Right.
But short selling can have a great utility in liquidity. So if you're a market maker, if someone's a market maker and you want to buy stock, the market maker can short the stock to you and then cover in the market, and that way you can get the stock at where the best price it's trading at right away. It happens very quickly. It's low cost, and the market maker covers. So short selling can be very useful for markets as well. How much it's abused, I think there are instances where, you know, a trader may spread rumors or basically, you know, badmouth a stock, and they have a short position and it declines,
right,
and they make money. There's a discrete rule with it's Rule 105, which is actively policed by the SEC today. And that's where if a stock is trading and the company is going to do another offering, if you know you're going to get stock in the offering, well, you know that they're going to price the stock below market on whatever their pricing day is, so you short it on Tuesday and it prices on Friday, you know, you've helped drive the stock down. You cover, you buy the stock and the offering cheaper, you make your risk-free profit. There's a rule, SEC Rule 105, that I spent a lot of time working on that, you know, seeks to stop that.
Right.
And that is heavily enforced by the SEC today.
But in any case, in the early, mid-2000s there, 2003-04, you're getting corporations, they're saying, you know, people are shorting our stock on purpose. I think it was Martha Stewart and some others. There was
all the financial services firms, not all of them, but some of them.
Yes.
Short selling is an issue that resonates on Main Street. It's not so much a partisan issue. It's more of a Main Street versus Wall Street issue, where it just doesn't sound good to Main Street that people sell what they don't own.
Right. And you actually got a lot of press, I think, in the middle of one of those discussions about short selling.
Well, there were a number of people who, when they lost money, they blame short sellers, and then they blame the SEC for not stopping short sellers. And that was, I don't think that's most people, but certainly there were people who wrote letters and complained to their congressmen and that sort of thing. And but, you know, in many cases, those people had invested, perhaps based on a chat room, in a company that was untested, highly risky, and when the company had, you know, problems and the stock went down, they were looking for someone to blame, and that was often the case. And sometimes short sellers sniffed out a bad company before other people.
But you did craft Reg Show,
we did.
And so there was some things that you could find that you did want to sort of.
Yeah, the fails. The idea that you should borrow and deliver stock if you're short selling.
Okay.
And that, so it's basically creating rules so that you could sell short, but when you did that, you had to borrow and deliver stock. And so the idea is, you know, when people purchase stock, it would be there. I mean, stock is fungible, but that was something Chairman Cox felt strongly about at the time. We worked on Reg Show in 04. He was there. Was there 04 or 08? In 08 as well. It was revised.
Yeah.
But Chairman, I think probably 08.
Okay.
Probably 08 that Chairman Cox was involved in, not 04.
And you had a threshold list. What was the function of that?
Well, The Threshold List was one of the first iterations of Reg's show. It was the idea, it focused on the idea that high levels of long-term, the regulation should police high levels of long-term fails. So are these companies which seem to be, people weren't delivering stock, and that's where the rules should bite.
Okay.
And that was really the 04 version, right. In 08, Chairman Cox, in a sense, toughened that up to move from the threshold list to basically moving to where if the stock wasn't delivered by the settlement cycle, which is trade plus three, T3, then the firm had to close out and buy the stock on the morning of T4. So that's what happened in 08.
Okay. And was there pressure to make that happen? What was there continued pressure from?
There was political pressure, sure.
Okay.
Sure.
And we skipped right over Sarbanes-Oxley and the implementation of rules surrounding that. Were you involved in some of those?
Only the research part. I mean, Sarbanes-Oxley also focused on accounting,
yeah.
Right? Because it was post-Enron.
Pretty heavily.
Right. But if there was a research component, and that's what I was involved in.
Okay.
So.
And I came across something that I'd never heard of before that had your name attached somewhere, which was married puts.
Well, married puts was another sort of short-selling strategy where a trader would pair the purchase of stock with the purchase of a put, which was a right to sell the stock. And it was basically a kind of a synthetic short-selling strategy.
Hmm.
And the commission, you know, viewed it as potentially abusive, but not always. But there was a concern again that people were could trigger a destabilizing movement in the stock through the use of married puts. That it was an effort to sort of get around short sale rules.
Okay. So, Reg Show, the first iteration, I guess, came out in 2005, and Reg NMS at the same time. And you mentioned earlier that, you know, a lot of these things that you were looking at led up to Reg NMS. Can you tell me a little bit about that process?
Well, that was really, more on some of the order handling issues that led up to NMS. I did not craft NMS, so
okay.
I'm not going to...
Okay.
I mean, I know something about it, but I really wasn't. That was Bob Colby and Dan Gray and some other folks. And Ned Nazareth.
Okay, so you touched a little bit on the Great Recession and the stock market sort of plunging there after Lehman Brothers. Any other fallout from that your group in market reg had to deal with?
Well, I think it's the beginning of the large trader rule that was adopted a couple of years later, because during the first meltdown, we saw some volatility late in the day where stocks would go down by 5% very quickly, and we wanted to know more about that. It was hard to do a market reconstruction. And ultimately, some years later, after the flash crash, when the markets dropped precipitously, and it took 3 months for the commission to do a reconstruction, finally, the commission adopted a large trader rule, which allowed it not only to identify large traders, but to be able to have a system of identification numbers that it could use to pull trading data quickly, so that when a market event happened, commission could do forensics much more quickly. So in a sense, that started with the meltdown.
Is this related to the audit trail?
Well, the consolidated audit trail will be a further way to track trading, and that's right. Large trader is a more limited tool, but an important one, which, again, will allow the commission to learn more and more quickly.
How did that tool work?
Well, the if you meet a threshold of trading to be a large trader, and if you are a large trader, you have to get an ID number. And broker-dealers have to have a capacity to track trading by ID numbers. So if the commission decides it wants to investigate trading in IBM on October 10th by large traders, it can ask the brokers for all that trading material and get it within 24 hours.
Okay.
So that's how the rule works.
So basically you can just start the investigation all that much sooner.
Yeah, right. So that was an important advancement, and I would jump to the 15C3-5, the market access rule, which basically requires broker-dealers who provide access to the markets for customers, usually institutional traders, and who access the markets themselves to have both financial controls to make sure that customers have credit, they can pay for what they're trading, and that the regulatory requirements are met before there are trades, and to prevent things like error trades, fat finger controls. The idea is to, which should help, limit flash crash opportunities.
And that came out of that.
That came out of that.
Okay.
And then the other, post-flash crash tools involved circuit breakers, limit up, limit down. The commission's taken a number of steps to address potentially, destabilizing activity and market glitches, which can drain confidence.
Right. So these were rules
operational
that
were
crafted, and
right.
Somebody has to decide, like, limit up, limit down. What were the specifics on that?
Well, basically that it's to prevent trades at going off at above beyond a band where the market's mm-hmm. trading, so that it's to prevent it, in a sense, if you think of it as an erroneous trade, if the market is 10 to 10.02, a trade should not be going off at $50.
Right.
Right. So limit up, limit down prevents executions beyond the market band. And the market can move naturally, but again, it's designed to prevent trades at absurd prices.
It's not going to take great leaps, I guess.
Oh, yeah. Leaps that are not, clearly are not a function of supply and demand. They're
right.
A function of some error.
Now, didn't we have the market break in 87? There was a lot of talk about circuit breakers and things like that at that point. Was that just for the exchanges themselves? The SEC wasn't involved at that point?
Well, I think the SEC was involved. I mean, I was in the general counsel's office till then.
Right.
And that was actually when Congress gave the commission large trader authority, I believe.
Okay.
But the commission proposed but did not adopt a rule because everyone was so opposed to it.
All right, we're getting down to some of the issues of recent times. Dark pools. I know that you were involved in some respects with that.
Well, one of the things that we wanted to determine was how, ATS's dark pools, what they disclose to customers about how they handle their orders, and that's an important focus still today. That's pretty recent. So basically the idea is to make sure that when customers provide liquidity, send their orders to whatever trading platform, that they understand how those orders will be treated, where they'll be sent, who will get to see the orders, and that was an important goal. Was there, we were surveying firm practices on that issue, and we continue to that continues to be a focus at the SEC. Also, the idea of in 2009, the commission proposed a release to require trade reporting by venue, so that when a trade was executed in a particular dark pool, it would be identified as such. That release was not adopted, but FINRA, the SRO, just did a version of that concept at a lower level, not as specific as the commission had proposed. But So that brings additional transparency to dark pool activity, which is important.
Was this another one of those Wall Street versus Main Street issues?
No, I think there's fair amounts of support for that. No, I don't really think there's a real split on that. You know, again, there was a rough consensus on that there should be some additional transparency. I mean, it's really hard to argue with. Wall Street did not necessarily, I mean, I don't know that Wall Street was fungible, but they didn't want a trade-by-trade disclosure on the consolidated tape of which dark pool that they would have been comfortable with end-of-day aggregated statistics. So, no, I think there is probably some level of consensus that additional transparency was warranted there.
Okay.
There are a number of areas where it's not, you know, the industry isn't just opposed to regulation, but there's kind of a middle ground that could be reached.
Right. What's another one? You say there's a number of areas like that.
Oh, I mean, I think a lot of the, you know, some of the rules that were proposed, the commission proposed that there's a display rule for orders.
Right.
You know,
right.
And the commission proposed that these actionable indications of interest, which function like orders, ought to be displayed. And I think there was considerable support for that. It was not adopted. But, I mean, things like after the flash crash, the circuit breakers, limit up, limit down, had a lot of industry support.
Right.
So
at this point, are you an associate director?
Yeah, well, I became an associate director in 2006 to 2009, and then deputy from 2009 to 2011, and co-acting director from April to December 2009.
Right. Well, did that work pretty well, having two acting directors?
Well, it did, because Dan Gallagher and I kind of split responsibilities, and because there were different units of the division, that was entirely smooth, and we each kind of had our own domains, and then on management issues and so forth, we worked together, and it went virtually seamlessly. Although we would have been happy to have Eric Seward stick around for a while.
How much can a director shape sort of the agenda and the focus of?
Significantly.
Yeah.
Of course, it all starts with the chairman. The chairman's the most important and influential person. The chairman sets the agenda. But if you're a division director and if you've come to work for a chairman, hopefully you have good working relationship, and the chairman has faith in you and listens to you, and the chairman's got a lot to do, has lots of divisions to worry about.
Right.
So I think there's a real opportunity for the director to not only make recommendations, but you know, just really push a lot of things through. And then there's a lot of action at the staff level that should happen. Things like no action letters and exemptions, staff legal bulletins, guidance. I think there's quite a bit of administration of rules that is done at the staff level and should be, that the director can supervise.
Yeah, you emphasize the importance of no action letters, which is sort of an inverse way of governing something. I mean, you're essentially telling people, we've thought about it, go ahead and do that, right?
That's right, because rules are very blunt instruments, and, markets evolve, activities evolve, rules are not written to fit all these specific activities, so you can have an activity that technically violates a rule but doesn't cause the harm the rule was trying to prevent. So it's, and often can be a very useful and legitimate activity, whether to conduct a transaction or a certain trading activity, and a no action letter can allow that useful market activity to get done while at the same time preserving the protections that the rule was designed for. So you can build in conditions and you're giving relief based on certain representations. So it's it's a way to sort of further scope the rules and make the rules like, you know, a laser rather than a shotgun. Mm-hmm. So the process is a good one.
All right, but it's subtractive in a way rather than additive.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's... I guess I would say it's more sculpting.
Yeah.
And conditions also can be rigorous. So the conditions can limit the sort of subtraction.
So were there issues or sort of ongoing challenges that kept coming back again throughout your time at Market Rig?
Well, I think that one of the greatest challenges is sort of getting business information. Right? The commission can have lots of smart lawyers, economists, accountants, and whomever else, and they can work hard, and they do work hard. But they don't have traders and bankers by and large, and it's often the there's a real deficit in terms of knowing the activity that's going on, and that's the hardest thing for the commission to get. Now, the commission has recently, been able to hire some fellows and other people who've worked in industry, and I think that's a good thing, and some people with quantitative expertise, and I think that really, that's the more that, the better. That's smart.
But that wasn't happening in the 2000s.
It was somewhat, but it was geared up more lately, and I think it's a good trend.
Okay. Any challenges, any problems that you worked on over and over again? As far as rulemaking, or
I think the challenge is sometimes. I mean, it's very challenging to get. There's an inertia principle. There's, there's a limited number of meetings the commission has to hear rules. So other rules go through this seriatim process where they go commissioner to commissioner, and basically one commissioner can hold something up. And the only remedy is for the chairman to put it on the calendar. And that may be contentious or not. So in order to get a lot of rulemaking done, you need a chairman who wants to get it done. And that's, not always the case.
Did any of the chairmen that you served under particularly want to get it done?
Well, I think they all had different priorities. And so there were things that were important to them. In my view, in general, the commission, the staff does the work, and the more of it should be sort of brought to fruition, because it's good. Too much gets held up. It's not just new rules. Sometimes it's deregulating.
Mm. But this is held up sort of by the commission structure.
Right. And sometimes it is even guidance or a no action process. I think the commission should be very active in giving guidance and again, whether it's no action, whether it's a new rule, whether it's answering FAQs, frequently asked questions. I think the commission ought to be engaged. Because if it doesn't do that, sometimes the vacuum is filled by enforcement, in a sense, and I don't mean just the commission, SRO enforcement, examiners on the ground who can kind of impose conditions that may not be evident from the rules, so the industry can get surprised.
Was there a time in your career when that was particularly a problem?
I think later, the latter part of the career was harder, but it's always been challenging. And sometimes there can be different amounts of sort of general counsel review. General counsels can be very conservative about doing anything, because, to some extent, they may see action as a tailing risk, whatever the action
is. Right. One issue that we haven't spoken about is high-frequency trading. And, we talked about the flash crash, and I believe you were involved in looking into high-frequency trading toward the end there.
Well, high-frequency, the commission has been for a while, sensitive to and surveilling for trading that's abusive, whether you call it high-frequency or not. Trading shouldn't be manipulative, and it shouldn't be front-running, and it shouldn't be based on MNPI. it's not necessarily a problem if it's fast.
What's MNPI?
Material non-public information. Okay. So there are all these, there are principles about that certain kind of trading can be problematic, but it's not simply because it's fast.
Right, I got that. But on the other hand, trading is getting faster.
And that, you know, the commission has been sensitive to operational issues, so the market access rule is very important. That's key, and that's a big step to sort of, you know, policing, you know, rogue high-frequency traders if they're out there.
Okay.
The other thing the commission is considering, I believe, is making sure that Chair White has spoken of this, that any high-frequency trader that's not registered ought to be registered as something so the SEC can examine it, or FINRA can. So I think there are steps that need to be taken. Any high-frequency trader that's a significant one should be registered. And that would also create a level playing field with the brokers who are registered. So, and the Reg SEI that the Commission has proposed to have more operational capability as a higher priority in the markets. It already is a high priority, but, you know, that's very, that's another step to sort of protect the market's integrity.
Okay.
So, you know, it's not a matter of saying high-frequency trading is bad or good if there are manifestations or activity that's, you know, need to be addressed, and then they should be.
Right. A useful sense of perspective, I guess. Did Dodd-Frank pretty much occupy
I worked on some aspect. You know, there were quite a few rules that it required, basically a scheme of regulation for security-based swaps, which were kind of over-the-counter derivative, and the CFTC has most authority over most swaps, and the SEC has a limited number, but important ones like credit default swaps. So, you know, there were rules, you know, I worked on a couple of rules with people, and they were rolling out slowly, and, you know, they're still largely unfinished.
So. Right. It's a huge job implementing Dodd-Frank.
Well, it is, but, you know, again, I think that, you know, commission, you know, needs to move at a certain pace.
Yeah. Your decision to come to Sidley, were you just, you know, felt like it was time to head out?
There was an early retirement opportunity, and, I thought it was... there are always a variety of factors that cause one to leave.
Yeah.
And there were in this case.
So how has you've been here for a few years now?
2 years, 8 months now.
Okay. Has that changed your perspective on your time at the SEC? Have you come to look at it differently or appreciate things in a different way?
You know, not fundamentally. I missed my colleagues the day I left, and working with teams of people and in a way that was free of sort of commercial imperatives. Mm-hmm. You know, that you could just do the work you had to do with a team of people and not worry about, you know, billing it or whether a client would pay for it. It was a lot of work. We were working hard. But it's a little different, and getting to make policy is satisfying and fulfilling. There were frustrations because it was too slow. And I think you know, I truly believe there is a sensible center, and there are regulatory concerns that can be addressed with workable rules. And you know, Arthur Levitt had this little pad. He put a logo on pads that said something like "important work," you know, "good people, workable rules." But I'm not getting it quite right. But he really had it right.
Yeah.
So you know, and I think so. There is a way to get it done. And again, so since I've been here, I am concerned that we're seeing too much regulation by enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
And not enough by regulators.
Right. Anything else we should talk about before we call it quits?
No,
well, that's a great place to stop. Thank you very much.
Okay.